Gateway Market and Cafe is Des Moines' locally owned grocery and specialty food store, centrally located at ML King Parkway and Woodland Ave. Enjoy chef-crafted prepared foods, artisan baked goods, organic produce, hand-cut meats, local and international cheeses, wines, and craft beer. Gateway's Cafe is open for dine-in, carry-out, and delivery service 7 days a week. Stop by or visit gatewaymarket.com for more details. Gateway Market, good food, great community. Happy August, folks, and welcome to the Fallon Forum. Hey, thanks to our sponsors, including Gateway Market and Cafe. Gateway is Central Iowa's premier good food store and brings together the world's finest products with Iowa-grown foods and passionate personalized service. If you're looking for quality foods with a community focus, check out Gateway Market and Cafe. Thanks also to Central Iowa realtor Joe Henry. Residential, commercial, land. Joe's been covering all that for 23 years. He's also a leading community activist and a strong advocate for locally owned businesses. Call Joe Henry at 515-208-7312. Hey, thanks to the Des Moines Irish Session for providing our bumper music. And I'm flying solo today, folks, so thank you for being with me. And as always, feedback on this program, welcome. I want to start by referencing a captivating and also, I'd say, disturbing, very disturbing photograph. I found this, Rachel Garst posted it on Facebook. And it's a photograph of 11, 13-year-old girls. And it's back in 1945, so they all got the exact same haircuts. I know very little about hair. I'm follically deprived. But maybe it's like hair that comes halfway down your head, below your ear. I don't know what that is, but all of the exact same haircuts. And they're in a river. And some are standing, maybe waist deep. The others are kneeling, maybe up to their, you know, shoulders. And they all look very happy. And of course, they have modest bathing suits on because this is 1945. And behind them is a huge mushroom cloud. And it looks like it's right behind them. But apparently, it was about 40 miles away. And that mushroom cloud was the very first nuclear bomb ever detonated on planet Earth. It was the Manhattan Project's Trinity nuclear bomb, Trinity explosion. And when the girls heard it, they were sleeping at the time. They woke up with a start. They didn't know what it was. And then they saw this huge cloud form. Now, they had no idea this was happening. And neither did the thousands of people who lived in a 40-mile radius. And again, a 40-mile radius is not enough to accommodate all the impacts of a nuclear explosion. And within 150 miles, 500,000 people lived in that zone. Some people lived as close as 12 miles away. Not a single one of them was warned. No one was evacuated. In fact, no one was evacuated even after the test. You know, and radioactive fallout continues to come down from the sky for days. And yet no one was told that this was going to happen. No one was told what had happened. No one was evacuated from the area that scientists and government officials knew would be toxic. You know, now, in fairness, maybe not all of them knew, but enough of them knew that this was a huge danger, that something should have been done. Of course, they were trying to keep it secret from the Japanese. In the meantime, they keep it secret from Americans who are impacted by it directly. So the 13-year-old girls in this photo, I'm gonna post this photo in various places because I find it so gripping. One of the young girls in that photograph is Barbara Kent. And she wrote after the fact, quote, "We were all just shocked. And then suddenly a huge cloud appeared overhead, along with strange lights in the sky. It hurt our eyes to look up. The whole sky turned strange, as if an intense sun had come out." And so, You know, a few hours later, of course, that's when the white flakes started falling from the sky, and the girls were excited. They put on their swimsuits. They went to play in the river amid the falling, quote, snowflakes. They would grab the white flakes, and they, you know, thinking it was some kind of a snow, they would smear it on their faces, but they found out that it wasn't cold, it was hot. And they figured that was, well, that was just because it's the summertime, it's July. And, you know, Barbara admits, hey, we were 13-year-old girls. We didn't know. Well, again, nobody knew. They didn't tell anybody. Now, the most tragic part of this this photograph was that within 17 years, all but one of those girls had died of cancer. Every one of them, except for Barbara Kent. She was the only one to live beyond age 30. And she herself had several bouts of cancer. Again, the government knew what it was doing. Scientists knew what the impact would be. In fact, scientists thought it was possible. Some scientists thought it might be possible that this could set up a chain reaction across the entire world. But they were willing to take that chance, apparently. So one scientist, a guy named Dapo Michaels, he said he was unaware of the long-term effects, but when he realized the consequences, I mean, just in one example, these girls all dying of cancer before the age of 30, guilt overwhelmed him, and it led to a mental breakdown. He was eventually institutionalized, where he died. You know, we think of the victims of the first nuclear explosions as being the Japanese, and my heart goes out to the people of Hiroshima and Nagasaki even decades later. But we have to remember, too, we inflicted destruction on our own people, as well as on people living in the Marshall Islands, for example, some of the areas in the South Pacific where tests were conducted by the U.S. and also by France. But the before the nuclear testing program was switched to underground in Nevada, at the Nevada test site, there were over 100 above-ground nuclear tests. The first one being in July of 1945, 100. And I came across a map of the winds that would push the fallout from these tests to the west. And occasionally there would be, sorry, to the east. Occasionally some of the fallout would go to the west, but usually it went east. Utah was the most heavily impacted state. But Arizona, New Mexico, Wyoming, even Iowa got a taste of the radioactive material being released by these 100 nuclear tests. Even as far east as New Jersey got a small taste of it. But again, the biggest impact right there. And so a group of victims, people started realizing, people who lived downwind from the nuclear tests realized that, we're seeing unprecedented rates of cancer. And they formed a group called Downwinders. And again, these 100 tests were conducted between 1945 and 1963, so just under 20 years. And I don't know whether people were eventually alerted to the fact that there would be a nuclear test, but if you look at the map of the where the radioactive clouds went, you're going to notify half the country. You know, it's crazy to think that we did that, and 100 times before we moved these tests underground. Which I'm not saying that's a great thing. It created a whole new set of problems. I'm glad that by 1996 we put in place a nuclear test ban treaty. But in 1963, that's when the underground tests stopped, because there was a treaty signed by the U.S., the USSR, and Great Britain called the Limited Test Ban Treaty. That went into effect in 1963. But the impacts of the tests continued to wreak havoc on lots of people living downwind. And so the states, back in 1990, there was something called the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act. Yeah, well, not till 1990, almost 30 years after the last test, they finally appropriated some money. The federal government appropriated some money to compensate the victims for the health impacts of these tests. And they were all living in Nevada, Utah, Arizona, and New Mexico. And again, yeah, that's where the largest group of downwinders lived. But, you know, Idaho's not that far away. And when the wind came from the south, as it did during some of these tests, Idaho residents were affected. And they were excluded from any compensation until this year. Remarkably, it was this year in the big budget bill that they finally allowed funding to be given to victims of radiation poisoning in Idaho. Just last month. So again, kudos to the Republican Congress and President Trump for doing something right. And that's probably all I'm going to say about President Trump in a favorable way today. But I want to move on. I have lots of friends who voted for Donald Trump. I get really, really ticked off at my liberal friends, and not most of them, but there are some on the extreme fringe of the left wing who I had a conversation the other day. Yeah, it was disturbing. Someone who insisted that it's that all Trump voters are racist or misogynist or stupid or bad people. And if Trump does anything bad, they're responsible. I get so sick of that. I get so tired of that. There's an unwillingness to listen to any reason why somebody might have voted for Donald Trump. Again, I don't commend the decision. And I think Trump is the most dangerous person ever to be in charge of this country. I think he is a fascist. I think he's leading us in that direction. I will pull no punches there. But to put all the blame or enough of the blame on the people who support him for one reason or another is so, so wrong. So I came across something I want to share with you. It's somebody named Dark Brandon. I don't know who Dark Brandon is, but he created a clip with a cartoon figure of Jesus, and it was a respectful Jesus. It had a little element of South Park, some of those edgy cartoons, but none of the language. And I thought it was worth sharing, so I am going to share that with you.
Hey there, folks. Hope you're doing well today. You know, I left for 2,000 years. I come back, and somehow my biggest followers are obsessed with a golden idol who builds towers, cheats on his wives, and brags about it on live TV. Evangelicals, what happened? I turned water into wine. You turned scripture into a tax shelter for billionaires. I said, love your neighbor. You said, build a wall. And then handed the hammer to a guy who paid hush money to a porn star while his third wife was home with a newborn. I healed the sick for free. He tried to strip health care from 30 million people and called it a win. I fed the poor with loaves and fishes. He fed the rich with tax cuts and called the poor lazy. And yet, I'm the one you stopped inviting to church. Trump once held a Bible upside down in front of St. John's Church like it was a weapon. He didn't read it. He didn't open it. Pretty sure he thinks Corinthians is a hotel chain. But you cheered. You cheered when he tear gassed protesters so he could take a photo. Then you called it defending Christianity. Let's talk morality. You used to say character counts. Then he bragged about grabbing women by the and your response was, well, King David was flawed too. Oh, I know David. He wrote songs. Trump writes mean tweets at 2 a.m. in adult diapers. I preached, turn the other cheek. He said, punch him in the face and I'll pay your legal fees. I said, blessed are the meek. He said, only losers and suckers get buried in war. I told you not to store up treasures on earth. He stores them in Mar-a-Lago bathrooms next to classified documents and Diet Coke. And you still defend him. You call him God's instrument. Well, if God ever used an instrument that bankrupt four casinos and couldn't spell Bible, it wasn't for music. You think I care if he stands with Israel? I'm from Nazareth. That's literally next door. I was brown, Middle Eastern, broke, and unarmed. By today's standards, you'd have called ICE on me and said I was part of Hamas. Let's not pretend you're defending me. You're defending power, comfort, control, and maybe a timeshare in the rapture. You talk about family values, but you backed a man who mocked a war widow, called Haiti a shithole, and told four women of color in Congress to go back to where they came from. One of them is from Detroit. You wanted prayer in schools. Fine. But when kids prayed for their lives during school shootings, he sold more guns and blamed video games. And the worst part? You know, deep down, you know, he doesn't believe any of it. He's not one of you. He's not pretending anymore. He just figured out how to sell Jesus like a hat. He traded me in for a con man wrapped in a flag, holding a Bible like it's a menu at Denny's. I didn't die for this. I died for the poor, the oppressed, the outcasts, the same people you now call crisis actors and illegals. And let's not forget the golden rule. Treat others like you'd like to be treated. Unless they're gay or trans or immigrants, then suddenly it's religious liberty to treat them like garbage. Trump Tower, how poetic. A name built on sand, pride, and unpaid contractors. You didn't crucify me this time. You just branded me. And when the poor cry out, when the refugees beg for mercy, when the sick knock on your mega church door, you quote me, but you don't follow me. So no, I'm not angry. I'm disappointed. And when Judgment Day comes, don't look for me at the pulpit next to him. I'll be out back, hoping the people you turned away. And just so you know, he's not on the guest list.
Okay, so that's pretty hard-hitting, and maybe a little bit too hard-hitting in spots, but again, I have some pretty pretty conservative friends. I consider Chuck Hurley, a former state legislator, former leader of the family, head of the family leader, I consider Chuck a friend. Some people are appalled by that. I think Chuck's a decent guy. We disagree on a bunch of things, and I asked him one day, I says, so, you know, Chuck, you live a very moral life. You're very passionate about doing good in the world to the extent that you understand. We may not agree on all the details, but yeah, you do a lot of good in the world. I give him that. How do you possibly support somebody like Donald Trump? And this was years ago, before his second election. And I mean, two issues that Chuck cares really deeply about are abortion and gay marriage. And he and I are on the opposite side of those, as you can imagine. But he said, yeah, he admitted that Donald Trump was pretty awful, but he thought he would eliminate, outlaw abortion. And that's the reason he was going to support him. Well, I guess he did that. And we see how that's going. And I guess I would challenge my Christian friends who feel strongly about that issue or any other issue to look beyond the one or two issues that really drive you. And look at the big picture here. This is not a moral man in the White House. This is not a paradigm of virtue of any kind. This is not the kind of person you want to bring into your kids' elementary school classroom and give a talk on how to be successful in life. I mean, if Trump did that, if you invited him in, he gave a talk in your school, and he was honest, it would be a pretty awful lesson. don't be afraid to cheat on women. Don't be afraid to demean them. Don't be afraid to make fun of the handicapped. Disregard anybody who was in the military who got captured. You know, they're obviously clumsy people for getting captured. Line your house, make it be a mansion. Line it with gold. Make it as ostentatious and elaborate as possible. And all this. I've seen billboards that trouble me so much because it says Jesus is my savior, Trump is my president, and it's kind of, or variations on that, that kind of equate the two, Jesus and Trump, not that different, or Trump being not maybe the second coming, but Jesus's person on earth who's going to do his will. I don't know how any devout Christian of any point on the Christian perspective, from Quakers all the way to the most conservative evangelicals, I don't know how you can look at who Trump is, not just now, but in the past, and what he's doing now, and they see anything but the most immoral man possible. I mean, extending tax breaks for the wealthiest? Where in the Bible is that cool? I know Jesus said, give unto Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's. Yeah, I mean, just look at the Jesus of the Bible. Poor himself, helping the poor, feeding the poor, feeding 5,000, 10,000 people, depending on which book you read. You know, he does that. Trump and his Republican pals take away food stamps for tens of thousands of Americans, hundreds of thousands. And what, up to 30 million people are going to use their medical care, lose their Medicaid? I mean, the guy is so opposed to everything that I see as the core of Scripture that I don't understand how any Christian can find anything valuable in this president. But that's just me. I'm happy to continue to have this conversation. I will never demean you. If you're listening to this program and you voted for Donald Trump, you will never hear me demean you. I respect you. I understand that a lot of different things go into a decision. I also understand from people I talk with who did support Donald Trump that they're not getting what they thought they voted for. And if you're in that camp, let's talk a lot. We have a lot of conversation. And the most important part of that conversation is how can we work together to address the problems that are being created by a president who is doing things that you did not envision and who is doing things that are in direct contradiction to what you believe as a Christian, if you are a Christian. Anyway, we could have a long conversation about that, and I suspect for some of us, we will. Hey, I got to take a short break, folks. I'll be back in a minute with more conversation. This is Ed Fallon with you on the Fallon Forum.
Thanks to Central Iowa realtor Joe Henry. Residential, commercial, land, Joe Henry's been covering all that for 23 years. He's also a leading community activist and a strong advocate for locally owned businesses. Call Joe Henry at 515-208-7312. That's 515-208-7312. You're responsible for a lot, and it's easy to become overwhelmed, to feel helpless, even hopeless. What's not so easy is finding your way back to feeling and functioning better. Psychiatrist Dr. David Drake helps individuals and couples throughout Iowa with the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling. Dr. Drake also prescribes medication when needed, and his services are offered on a self-pay, negotiated fee basis. If you need help, don't delay. Contact Dr. Drake at daviddrakefamilypsychiatry.com.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Hey, thanks to the Catholic Peace Ministry, whose focus is on nuclear disarmament, the war between Israel and Hamas, the war in Ukraine, and the need to end the permanent war economy. Learn more at CatholicPeaceMinistry.com. Thanks also to Westrum Optometry. Dr. Joel Westrum and his staff are fluent in English and Spanish. The clinic is open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. until 5 p.m. and on Saturdays by appointment. That's Westrum Optometry. All right, again, Ed Fallon with you here, folks. I want to switch gears and talk about the future, the 2026 election specifically. So, you know, it's a typical tactic in politics is to distract the voters from your flaws by projecting them onto your opponent. And I am, or also related to that, taking your opponent's strengths and turning them into perceived weaknesses. I've seen that happen so many times. I saw it happen to me when I ran for Congress. I live as simply as anybody I know, and don't earn a lot of money, never have, don't want to. And yet being a money grabber was used against me when I ran for Congress. That was a huge twist, but they found a way to make that work. Another one they used against me was the way to deal with with crime is to try to, there's certainly people who have to be in prison. I got that. But a lot of them don't. Probably the majority of people in prison don't. And when it came to trying to figure out a way to deal with some of the sex offender population, a bill was offered that made it worse. And everybody knew it was worse, but people voted for it because they were afraid of how it was going to be used in a campaign against them. I was the only no vote because I saw what was going on. I saw that it wasn't a real solution. Well, that was used against me. It gets crazy, right? And of course, we're all very familiar now with how Donald Trump, called the 2020 election stolen. And interestingly, he still insisted it was stolen as he is preparing to steal the 2026 congressional election. And, I knew he was going to. A lot of us knew he was going to. It wasn't quite clear how, maybe. Maybe some people had it figured out earlier, but it's pretty clear now what the strategy is. Instead of waiting 10 years for the process has been in place forever, the census that takes place every 10 years, now they're going to do a special census in Texas. This all started in Texas. And by gerrymandering congressional districts there, they figure they can create five more solid Republican districts. And so California's response is, well, we're going to do the same thing here. And I hate it. I don't blame them. I do not blame Governor Newsom at all for having to take, they're taking that tactic, because it's there's so much at stake. Yet I will say that Democrats are going to lose this one. I'm not sure Democrats are going to lose the congressional election next fall, but I am sure, pretty sure, they're going to lose the gerrymandering effort. Because, you've got California, sure, maybe Illinois, maybe Maryland, but then you've got all these states, Ohio, Indiana, Missouri, Florida, where Republicans can do a lot more damage than whatever Democrats can do in their states. I have a lot of criticism for Iowa these days, but I will say one thing that Iowa remains really good at is redistricting. I mean, we do it every 10 years, and we do it with a nonpartisan agency, and the legislature is not allowed to tweak the map. They can vote it up or down. If they vote it down, then the services agency comes back with a second map that must be voted up or down, and then it's sent to the Supreme Court to determine what the final map will look like. When you look at a map of Iowa, you see four districts that seem very logical. Compare that with, again, some Democratic states, Illinois, but more often Republican states, where you've got crazy boundaries that are clearly not logical, except when you realize they're trying to create districts that work for the party in power. So, I do want to say a word about gerrymandering, because I was always wondering, where did that word come from, gerrymandering? Well, apparently it goes back to the early 1800s. A Massachusetts governor by the name of Elbridge Gerry, last name Gerry, he created districts for Congress back then, and I don't quite know whether the legislature was involved, but there was one district that was shaped like a salamander. And so critics of the redistricting effort in Massachusetts combined his name, Gerry, with the last half of the salamander name and came up with gerrymander. That's where that name comes from. That's kind of incredible. Gerrymandering. All right. So the bottom line is there are still plenty of places in the U.S. where Democrats might beat Republicans. And there are obviously seats where Republicans might shift as well. So I don't think Democrats need to be worried about the fact that this is going to create numerous new seats that are going to be going Republican. I mean, yeah, they should be worried about it. But I think if they want to put their effort into supporting solid candidates in districts that are marginal, they have a shot at that. They have a shot at counterbalancing that gerrymandering. And again, one of those is Iowa. There's at least two, maybe three seats here in Iowa that could go either way. Because remember, it wasn't that long ago that Iowa had three Democratic seats and one Republican seat. Now it's got four Republican seats. And there are probably other places in the country where that might happen. And you know, if you run on issues, on a message that resonates, on what's happening in the world and what you propose to do about it, that's stronger than any kind of effort to rig the vote. And I want to share with you my frequent guest, Jeffrey Weiss, poli-sci prof at Des Moines Area Community College. I think he nailed it in an email he sent to me this week. It was in response to my guest last week, who insisted that voting didn't matter. I'll read you what Jeffrey wrote. He says, yeah, voting matters. For example, women could not vote until 1920, and only some of them actually in 1920, not all of them. So again, you know, I mean, if voting didn't matter, women would have not had to fight to get the vote, is what he's saying. African Americans got to vote in 1965, and it's now being taken away from them. Native Americans, poor whites, also could not vote for the first several decades of the Republic, and I would add, nor could non-property owners. Jeffrey says, so in fact, voting does matter because for most of U.S. history, it has been taken away from segments of our citizenry by those in power who are threatened by it. And I would hold that out to people. I hear that from a lot of people. Voting doesn't matter. Well, again, if it didn't matter, they wouldn't be trying to take it away from us. If it didn't matter, Trump and his buddies would not be trying to gerrymander states to create Republican districts that they feel more confident they can win. So, you know, I'll read you the last thing Jeffrey wrote. So the people in power have historically, all the time throughout history, not just in the U.S., but across the world, they have fought to try to make it, when there are bad leaders, they have fought to try to make it difficult or impossible to vote. And we see that in Russia. I mean, how many years now has Putin been the dictator of Russia? You know, that didn't come by popular vote. It came from a rigged system. I would argue we already have a rigged system here between the Electoral College, the filibuster of the U.S. Senate, so many restrictive laws. Right now, Trump is talking about doing away with mail-in ballots. Yeah, so there's all kinds of reasons why we can see that voting does indeed matter. Because bottom line is, they wouldn't be trying to take it away from you if it wasn't an issue, if it didn't matter. Hey, got to take a short break, folks. I'll be back in a minute with more conversation on the Fallon Forum.
Catholic Peace Ministry is an independent nonprofit guided by an ecumenical board representing many faith traditions. Founded in 1980, Catholic Peace Ministry focuses on nuclear disarmament and ending the wars between Israel and Hamas and Russia and Ukraine. CPM's overarching concern is the need to end the permanent war economy, which must be challenged if we are to achieve lasting peace and justice. Learn more at CatholicPeaceMinistry.com.
At Westrom Optometry, Dr. Joel Westrom and his team provide a variety of services, including comprehensive eye exams, children's eye exams, and LASIK co-management. Whether strictly utilitarian or a fashion statement, your comfort and vision are Westrom's primary concern. Dr. Westrom and his staff will work closely with you to determine the best solution for your eyes, prescription, and lifestyle. Services are provided in English and Spanish, and the clinic is open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. till 5 p.m. and on Saturdays by appointment. That's Westrom Optometry, located in Des Moines East Village.
Hey, welcome back, folks. It's Ed Fallon with you here on the Fallon Forum. Thanks to our partners and our sponsors, including Story County Veterinary Clinic, where Dr. Kim Holding has been caring for all creatures, great and small, for over 30 years. Learn more at Story County Veterinary Clinic's Facebook page. Thanks also to Architecture by Synthesis. Owner Mark Clisham asks that you use the most energy-efficient methods you can afford and the greenest, longest-lasting materials available. Examples of Mark's work can be found at architecturebysynthesis.com. All right, so I want to tell you, folks, I could finally die a happy man. I'm ecstatic about this. I've always opposed the death business, big death, let's call it. it has never made any sense to me that one's body must be drained of fluids and replaced with a chemical, and then you are made up and place where people can stare at your corpse, and then you are buried in the ground in a box inside of a coffin that a casing that can be pretty much impermeable. And I say this from some experience. I worked at a graveyard for a couple months, and it was a grave experience. I learned a little bit about the industry. If it works for you, that's great. I don't want to fault any. I don't want to judge anybody who decides that the current system works great. I'm glad that the option of cremation has been introduced, but even that to me seemed like a waste of good flesh. You know, I mean, to me ideally, I want to be composted. I'm a big composter. That's a big part of my work here. Kathy and I use compost to create a garden space that is extremely productive. And again, I'm the one primarily responsible for making the compost, and I value that role. And yes, when we have animals that die, they become part of the compost as well. I've never understood the signs on composters. Do not include meat. Well, no, actually, that meat's a pretty good element of the composition process. And I don't know how all farms do this, but I've been to farms where I was at one dairy farm, and when a cow died, it was added to the big composting heap. And if the heap was made properly, that cow composted a lot quicker than if it was just left around to stink. So I'm excited to see that human composting services are now legal in some places. There's a story recently about a business called Recompose. I love that, Recompose. In Washington State, there was a USA Today story I saw, and I'll quote from it. Human composting is part of a trend in the funeral industry toward more sustainable and environmentally friendly burials. So-called green funerals include human composting, as well as other practices like foregoing chemical embalming and choosing green burial materials like biodegradable caskets. Yeah, so again, when I worked in a cemetery, we had to dig a 6-foot deep hole, and the body was in. Actually, wooden caskets weren't allowed. They were in caskets made from some kind of plastic material, and then those were put into a cement vault. And we would make the cement vaults in a building, then transport them to the gravesite. So you've got an embalmed body in an airtight casket made of plastic and metal, inside of a concrete, you know, bunker, basically, buried 6 feet underground. I mean, that to me is just offensive. I don't want to go that way. And to know that I now have the option, in some places, of becoming compost is pretty exciting. I cannot do it in Iowa yet. There are, about a dozen or more states that now allow composting. And there are a handful of other states that are working on it. Iowa is unfortunately not one of them. Now, I would love to see a do-it-yourself law where you could compost your own loved one. we could do that right here at Birds and Bees Urban Farm. But that's probably not going to be legal. I think the reason that big funeral has come around to agreeing to this is because they still get to control it. So Recompose, this business in Washington State, uses a process that it imitates the natural process of decomposition. So they put the body into a vessel that has a mixture of plant materials in there, also wood chips, straw, and alfalfa. Yeah. Probably not the best use of alfalfa, since that's pretty good food for animals. And then they calibrate that for each individual, and they do something called cocooning the remains. And they call it, they try to create this perfect environment for microbes. And, you know, that's what we do when we compost here. I mean, my goal, by combining weeds and leaves and rabbit manure, chicken manure, my goal is to get that compost pile hot enough where it hits 140, 160 degrees. The process goes a lot quicker. You have a better product. And it also, that temperature kills microbes, kills weed seeds as well as funguses. So yeah, I was impressed to learn that it takes only about 5 to 7 weeks for that body to decompose and turn into compost. And so then the material is removed from the vessel and it's allowed to cure for another 3 to 5 weeks before it can be used, and I quote again, as nourishment in parks, forests, or even gardens. So with any luck, I will be able to become compost, and if Birds and Bees Urban Farm is still going, I can be returned to this place that I love and help enrich the next generation of plants. Again, Big Death has cornered the market. They get to control this. I think that's why it is allowed to happen. You know, as a legislator, I saw so many turf battles. Licensure bills would come before the state government committee with one interest trying to either change the licensing requirements so we could have it could get in, and the entrenched industry fighting against the licensure proposal. We saw that with hairstyling, believe it or not, with interior design. I mean, some of these things, massage therapy, some of these things, maybe there needs to be some kind of oversight, but it ought to be minimal. It ought to not be to the extent that it prevents others from getting involved in that industry. We've seen it with taxi drivers too. Years ago, you had to be the big yellow taxi cab service in order to be able to, you know, provide taxi service in Des Moines. There were so many restrictions on, you know, that were in place that any small operator couldn't get in. And I think that's the same thing here. I think that, you know, the big funeral industry has opposed this, but now that they're being allowed to do it, they're okay with it. There is an opponent, one that I could come up with, and that's the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. I knew the Catholics would find a way to weigh in on this. They say, quote, it fails to satisfy the church's requirements for proper respect for the bodies of the dead, end quote. And you know what? That's fine. If you don't think it's respectful, then you should encourage all members of your church not to do it. But, you know, again, this is where that separation of church and state is so important. You know, we don't need a church coming in and telling somebody who happens to be a member of a different religion altogether what they should and shouldn't do. So, you know, I mean, I was curious about the history of this too. So, again, the funeral industry is pretty recent. It came about in the early part of the 20th century, because people used to just be, you know, dead people were dealt with at home, you know. Funerals came out of people's homes, into the church. But again, they tried to create this this modern approach to funerals that tried to provide some meaning and purpose and formal recognition of the value of that person's life. And I get that, and I understand why a lot of people might still think that's the best way to go. But I'm delighted to see that more and more people are thinking, well, I mean, look at how many people now choose cremation. And I mean, and the fact that now we have more than a dozen states that allow this type of green burial, that's good. It's encouraging. I just wish that there was less control of the whole process by one big industry. Anyway, one more thing I want to talk about in this segment before we move on is the plastics treaty. There was a CNN headline this past week, quote, talks to finalize the world's first treaty on plastic pollution in Geneva, Switzerland, collapsed in failure Friday as countries remain bitterly divided on how to tackle the crisis. And yeah, it's hard not to understand, admit that we have a huge problem with plastics. We've talked about that on this program before, about how microplastics are everywhere. I mean, everywhere in your body, in your brain. I mean, everywhere in the air, in the water, in the soil. We've got so much of this crap out there. It's unavoidable and it's not good. It's horrible. So, I mean, I'm glad that the world finally recognized that to the point of wanting to come together and try to create some kind of a treaty to regulate the plastic industry, to put caps on production, to try to move away from plastics to more sustainable options. And there are so many things you could do in your own life. I mean, when I go into a restaurant, the first thing I say is, water, please, no ice, no straw. And a lot of places have stopped serving straws. Good for them. And some serve, they won't give you a plastic straw, they'll give you a paper straw, which I guess Donald Trump hates that. But he and I don't tend to frequent the same restaurants. A lot needs to be done, and it needs to be an international effort. Because this stuff is everywhere. There's a huge vortex of plastic floating in the Pacific Ocean. There are beaches in countries around the world, especially in the tropics area, that are just covered, littered with plastics. And part of the problem is we've been able to ship a lot of our plastic pollution overseas. And yeah, I think it's becoming more and more clear that recycling is a joke. There are some things that can effectively be recycled, not most. And we tend to believe that when we put a piece of plastic in the recyclable bin, we've done our part. Well, probably not. And I remember being at the State House, the state legislature decided, well, we need to recycle as well. So they had little blue recycling baskets. And legislators and clerks and pages would put the appropriate plastic item in that recycling bin. Well, I tracked it one day and I found out where it went. They brought it downstairs and they tossed it in with the rest of the garbage. So we clearly need action. We clearly need an effort. And so again, I'm glad they came together, but it's really disappointing. What I have to tell you is very disappointing. The oil and gas producing countries, they argued that the treaty, they said the treaty should focus more on recycling and reuse and redesign than production caps or even phasing out the chemicals involved in plastics. And the oil and gas industry spent a lot of money lobbying to make this happen. And again, most of the countries, over 100 countries, wanted to take solid action. And a handful of very powerful countries that are dependent on petroleum production are the ones that prevented it from happening. Probably no surprise, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Iran, and then Iran's best friend, the United States, and also Russia. I mean, these are the countries, and especially when you're talking about the US and Russia, big countries that could have had a big influence and didn't. We failed again. Yeah, so anyway, that's very disappointing. We need to know about it. And we need to take action in our own lives. That's a great start. It's always a great starting point to do, to be that change you want to see in the world. Or the companion to that I've been using sometimes lately is resist the change you don't want to see in the world. We need both of those approaches, carrot and stick. Anyway, I got to take a short break. Ed Fallon with you on the Fallon Forum. Back in a minute with more conversation. Architecture by Synthesis provides planning, design, and design build services for high performance, low maintenance, affordable homes and buildings. Owner Mark Klipsham asks that you use the most energy efficient methods you can afford and the greenest, longest lasting materials available. Examples of Mark's work can be found at architecturebysynthesis.com. That's architecturebysynthesis.com.
At Story County Veterinary Clinic, Dr. Kim Holding has over 30 years of experience working with all creatures, great and small. Cat, dog, horse, cow, elephant. Well, if you've got a pet elephant, you may be in trouble. Kim's clients stick with her year after year because they know she'll do right by them and their pets and farm animals. So give Kim a shout to keep your animals happy and healthy. Call 515-232-8766. That's 232-8766. Thank you.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Hey, thanks to our sponsors, including psychiatrist Dr. David Drake. If you live in Iowa, wherever you live in Iowa, Dr. Drake can help through the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling offered on a self-pay, negotiated fee basis. Contact David Drake, familypsychiatry.com. All right, welcome back. And again, I always try to mix it up. Bad news, good news, bad news, good news. You know, there's a lot of bad news out there, but there are good things happening too. And here's a good thing. So, I assume there are schools elsewhere in the country that are also fighting back against some of what is happening at the federal level and in some states, like here in Iowa, at the state level. But we've had some schools in the Des Moines Metro that have said, "Yeah, we're not gonna recognize the pressure being put on us by the Trump administration," because the Trump administration has put out executive orders that are against transgender inclusive policies. I hate it when the Republican Party is able to basically frame the conversation about politics around one issue, one hot button issue like transgender equality. You know, the bottom line is, it's nobody's business. If that's who you are, that's who you are. Let's move on and talk about the stuff we really need to be working on. But anyway, you know, I do respect and admire and appreciate schools that are willing to say, you know, we're gonna tackle that differently than you want us to. So, you know, Trump had threatened to cut federal funds and school lunch program money at public schools that had transgender inclusive policies. The Iowa Association of School Boards recommended deleting gender identity from the policy because of that law. So, unfortunately, they buckled to the pressure from the administration. But one school district here in central Iowa, Urbandale, the school board decided not to remove the protections. And again, at the state level, gender identity is no longer a protected class under the Iowa Civil Rights Act because of actions that the legislature and Kim Reynolds took earlier this year. So Urbandale said, quote, "We will continue to foster knowledge of, respect, and appreciation for the historical and contemporary contributions of diverse cultural groups, including race, color, national origin, gender, sex, marital status, sexual orientation, gender identity, disability, religion, creed, and socioeconomic background." And one of the school board members, Margaret Young, said, quote, "I don't want to be in a district that says most of you belong instead of everyone." So she voted, along with the rest of the board, the majority, to keep the policy the way it is. We'll see if there's any pushback from either the state or the federal government on that. But, it's what some of us have called anticipatory disobedience. because we've seen too many institutions that they anticipate being attacked by the Trump administration, so they come into what they see as compliance before they even have to. Well, this is kind of, okay, we anticipate that eventually we're going to be losing funds to this, but we're going to stand our guns and we're going to say, okay, this may be not what the federal government wants us to do, but, you know, here's what really gets me to. Education has always been mostly a local issue. I mean, when I was a legislator, I wanted to see the state involved as little as possible, let alone the federal government. And when Ted Kennedy hooked up with, who was it now? I forget, John McCain maybe, to push the No Child Left Behind Act, that to me was a terrible intrusion into local authority by the federal government. And I think it proved to be a disaster. You know, this is Trump and his government now getting involved in trying to micromanage education, trying to tell schools what they can and cannot do. And so good for Urbandale for standing up and saying, no, we got this. We're going to continue to respect everybody. We don't care what their religion, their gender, their orientation, whatever. It doesn't matter. We're going to respect everybody. Okay, one more thing I want to talk about here is political fundraising scams. And I do not know if there is an equivalent on the Republican side, but this one is a scam on the Democratic side. And it's an article from the Nation. An analysis was done showing that if you give $100 to an appeal run by a leading Democratic Party vendor, a whopping $1.60 will actually go to the political campaign. Wow. So your $100 donation is really $1.60. And this is why when I make donations to politicians, I don't give to parties at all. When I did make donations to candidates, I give them cash or I give them a check. And I strongly encourage that because there are some that are legit, sure. But they're all going to take a cut. Every service out there is going to take some kind of a cut. So I'll share a bit from the Nation's story with you here. One arm of the Democrats' political operation is humming along its nonstop fundraising appeals in email inboxes and text messaging accounts. These frenetic pitches are no doubt familiar to many Nation readers. They invoke some pending MAGA outrage, suggest the imminent collapse of the Republic is nigh, and hit you up for a small donation. Many of them are couched in the voice of a prominent Democratic leader or candidate, introducing themselves by their first names and addressing the recipient in the same fashion as though from a neighborhood bar stool. I like that. I'll keep going here. These ubiquitous pleas known as churn and burn come-ons are more than just a reflection of a panicking opposition party trying to stoke voter enthusiasm. They are increasingly the reigning business model of a Democratic establishment, otherwise unable to effectively oppose the MAGA movement. And as a revealing investigation by political spending sleuth Adam Bonica shows, these appeals are scams. I'll stop there and remind you that I'm not quoting from some kind of a Republican attack piece on Democrats. This is from The Nation. The Nation is one of the more liberal publications in the country. It's been around for a long time. It's got a good reputation. This is where the criticism is coming from. And one of their reporters, Spending Sleuth, I'm not sure what his title is, but Adam Bonica, quote, combed through FEC filings to document the money flows generated by the Democrats' largest private vendor for churn and burn appeals. That group is called Mothership Strategies. And Bonica found that most of the small donations kicked up in this fashion stay firmly in the orbit of the Democrats' privately contracted fundraising complex. Of the $676 million that Mothership has raised since 2018, $159 million went to Mothership's own coffers as consulting fees. Other money streams are likewise far afield from campaign work. $70 million of the money went to Mothership's payroll. $150 million more went for consulting outlays. And most of these expenses, Bonica writes, quote, appear to be administrative costs or media buys that feed back into the fundraising machine itself. Meanwhile, Mothership has its own hefty outlays for vendor support. One firm specializing in these pseudo-personalized text come-ons called Message Digital LLC pulled in $22.5 million during the same period. Wow, I am surprised this doesn't get more news coverage. I'm surprised that the Republican press isn't all over this. And again, I've always been very careful about this. If I do a monthly donation, automatic donation, I do it to some entity that I am very, very confident in. And there's only a handful that I'll do that with. I have to be very, very confident. Otherwise, I'm giving donations of cash or writing a check. So apparently Mothership was founded 11 years ago by two veterans of the digital arm of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, the DCCC, Greg Berlin and Charles Starnes, and they took the churn and burn strategies they'd honed at the DCCC and they converted it into proprietary assets as private contractors. And again, I'm reading from the story. And to keep the cash flowing in their direction, they also founded a host of plausibly goo-goo sounding satellite groups to authorize and circulate fresh torrents of fundraising asks. The partners thus, quote, became the operational heart of a sprawling nexus of interconnected political action committees, many of which they helped create and which now serve as their primary clients. This is just incredible. I strongly recommend you check out this story. It goes on and on. It's just, again, I am shocked that the Republicans have not jumped all over this. I'm shocked that more and more people aren't saying, you know, I think I'm just going to give you a check. You know, again, I think it's important to support with whatever, with your money to the extent that you can. I think it's important to support organizations, nonprofits, political candidates that you believe in. That's important. But you ought to know where every penny of it goes. And if you're giving to any one of these Democratic operations through the Mothership Network, according to this research, if your $100 donation, if you think that's going to your candidate, probably about $1.60 is actually going. Anyway, ha. Huh. Okay, so thanks for joining me today, folks. Again, Ed Fallon going solo this week. Kathy is on a writer's retreat. She's working on a book, which will be a fantastic book. It'll be the best book ever. She'll be sharing that with you, I'm sure, at some point on this program. But in the meantime, we'll have more conversation for you next week. But I want to say thanks to our production team, Sherry Herdina, Forrest Detterman, Charles Goldman, Kathy, and myself, Ed Fallon. Thanks also to our local small business partners, Gateway Marketing Cafe, Story County Veterinary Clinic, Western Optometry, David Drake Family Psychiatry, real estate agent Joe Henry, and Architecture by Synthesis. Thanks also to our nonprofit partners, Catholic Peace Ministry, Iowa Physicians for Social Responsibility, Bold Iowa, Birds and Bees Urban Farm, and Climate March. And finally, thanks to the Des Moines Irish Session for providing our bumper music. I'll be back next week, folks, with another hour of hopefully cutting-edge talk radio.